This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents A Memory of Light, Book 14 of The Wheel of Time, by Robert Jordan and Brendan Sanderson. Read for you by Michael Kramer and Kate Redding.
Chapter 20. Into Thakandar. Later in the day, after her meeting with Rand, Egwene thrust Vora's Sangreal out in front of her and wove fire. Threads came together, tiny glowing ribbons forming a complex weave in the air before her. She could almost feel their heat shining upon her, turning her skin a violent orange. She finished the weave, and a fiery ball as large as a boulder arced in the air, crackling and roaring. It fell upon the distant hilltop like a meteor. The blast flung bow-wielding Trollocs aside, scattering their carcasses. Romanda opened a gateway beside Egwene. Romanda was among the Yellows who had insisted on staying at the battlefront to provide emergency healing. She and her small crew had been invaluable in saving lives. Today, however, there would be no opportunity for healing. The Trollocs had pulled back into the hills, as Bryn had indicated they would. After a day and a half of rest, many of the Aes Sedai were recovered. Not to full strength, not after over a week of grueling combat, but enough. Gawain jumped through the gateway right after it opened, his sword out. Egwene followed, along with Romanda, Lilaine, Lyanna, Sylviana, Raymasa, and a handful of warders and soldiers. They stepped out onto the very hilltop Egwene had just cleared. The charred earth was still warm under her feet, blackened. The scent of burned flesh hung in the air. This hill was in the very middle of the Trolloc army. All around, shadow spawns scrambled for safety this way and that. Romanda held the gateway, and Sylviana began weaving air to create a dome of wind against arrows. The rest of them began to send weaves outward. The Trollocs reacted slowly. They'd been waiting here in these hills, ready to surge down into the valleys as Egwene's army entered. Normally this would have been a disaster. The Trollocs could rain projectiles down on Egwene's troops, and her cavalry would have been at a disadvantage trying to get up those hills. The hilltops would have given the Trollocs and Fades a better perspective to spot weak points in Egwene's forces and attack accordingly. Egwene and her commanders had been disinclined to give the enemy that advantage. The beasts scattered as the battle reversed on them, Aes Sedai seizing the hilltops. Some of the beasts tried to charge up and retake them, but others scrambled away for their lives. Egwene's heavy cavalry came next, thundering through the valleys. What had once been a very effective position for the Trollocs became a killing field. With the Trolloc archers removed by Aes Sedai, the heavy cavalry could kill practically unmolested. That opened the way for the Foot, who marched in formation to sweep the Trollocs back, smashing them against hillsides so that the Aes Sedai could kill them in groups. Unfortunately, the Trollocs had grown more accustomed to facing the One Power. Either that or the Murdral had grown more thorough at encouraging them. Soon, more coordinated groups of Trollocs charged the hilltops, while others managed to form resistance to the Foot assault. Bryn is right, Egwene thought, leveling a contingent of Trollocs that had almost clawed their way to her. The Fades are linked to the Trollocs again. The Shadow Spawn had been hesitant to use that tactic recently, as killing the Fade would drop all linked Trollocs. However, she suspected that it was the only way they could make the Trollocs climb toward almost certain death on these hills. If she could find the Murdral linked to the Trollocs nearby, she could stop them all with one well-placed weave of fire. Unfortunately, the Fades were crafty and had begun hiding among the Trollocs. "They're closing in," Lilaine said, panting. "Fall back," Egwene said. They ducked through Romanda's gateway, followed by their warders. Romanda came last, leaping through as a group of Trollocs claimed their hilltop. One of the beasts, a shaggy-furred, bear-like monstrosity, stumbled through the gateway after her. The thing dropped dead immediately, a faint wisp of smoke rising from its carcass. Its fellows hooted and growled on the other side. Egwene glanced at the other women, then shrugged and released flames straight through the gateway. A few fell dead, twitching, while the others scrambled away, howling, dropping their weapons. "That is effective," Lyanna noted, folding her arms and raising an immaculate eyebrow at the gateway. It was the middle of the last battle, and the woman still took time each morning to do her face. Their gateway had taken them back to camp, which was now mostly empty. With the reserves formed up and ready to move when required, the only soldiers who remained in the camp were a force of 500 guarding Bryn's command tent. She still carried the pouch with the false seals at her side. Rand's words had shaken her hard. How would they get the seals back? If the minions of the Shadow broke them at the wrong time, it would be a catastrophe. Had they broken them already? Would the world know? Egwene felt a dread she could not abandon. And yet, the war continued, and she had no recourse but to keep fighting. They would think of a way to recover the seals, if they could. Rand swore to try. She wasn't certain what he could do. "They're fighting so hard," Gawain said. Egwene turned to find him standing a short distance away, inspecting the battlefield with his looking glass. She felt a longing from him. Without some men to lead, as he had the younglings she knew, he felt useless in these battles. "The Trollocs are driven by Murdral," Egwene said. "Linked, to give the Fades greater control over them."
"Yes, but why resist so strongly?" Gawain said, still looking through the glass. "They don't care about this land. It's obvious that these hills are lost to them, and yet they fight savagely. Trollocs are base. They fight and win, or they scatter and retreat. They don't hold land. They're trying to do so here. It's like the Fades think that even after a rout like this one, they're in a good position."
"Who knows why Fades do what they do?" Lilaine remarked, arms folded, looking through the still open gateway. Egwene turned, looking through it too. The hilltop was now empty, strangely isolated amid the battle. Her soldiers had crashed up against the Trollocs in the small valley between the hills, and the fighting was brutal down there. She heard grunts, yells, clangs. Bloodied pikes were raised in the air as a group of men were forced back, and halberdiers moved in to try to slow the Trollocs. The Shadow Spawn were taking terrible casualties. It was an oddity. Bryn had expected them to retreat. "Something's wrong," Egwene said, the hairs of her arms standing on end. Her worry about the seals vanished for now. Her army was in danger. "Gather the Aes Sedai and have the army pull back." The other women looked at her as if she were mad. Gawain took off at a dash toward the command tent to give her orders. He didn't question.
"Mother," Romanda said, letting her gateway die.
"What is..."
Something split the air on the other side of Egwene's war camp, opposite the battlefield. A line of light, longer than any gateway Egwene had seen. It was nearly as wide as her camp itself. The line of light turned upon itself, opening a view that was not of southern Kandor. Instead, it was a place of ferns and drooping trees. Though they were brown, like everything else, they were still alien and unfamiliar. An enormous army stood silently upon this unfamiliar landscape. Thousands of banners flew above it, emblazoned with symbols Egwene didn't recognize. The foot soldiers wore knee-length garments that appeared to be some kind of padded armor, reinforced with chain in a large squared pattern. Others wore metal shirts that seemed sewn from coins tied together. Many carried hand axes, though of a very strange design. They had long, thin handles that bulged like bulbs at the end, and the axe heads were narrow and thin, almost like picks. The hafts of all of their weapons, from pole arms to swords, had a flowing, organic design, smooth and not of a uniform width, made of some dark red wood that had been painted with colorful dots down the sides. Egwene took in all of this in moments, her mind searching for any kind of origin for this strange force. She found nothing to latch onto until she sensed the channeling. The glow of Sidar surrounded hundreds of women, all of them riding, wearing strange dresses made entirely of stiff black silk. The dresses were not tied at the waists, but instead pulled relatively tight around the shoulders and flared wide toward the bottoms. Long rectangular tassels of a multitude of colors hung from ties at the hoods of women, all of them riding, wearing strange dresses made entirely of stiff black silk. The dresses were not tied at the waists, but instead pulled relatively tight around the shoulders and flared wide toward the bottoms. Long rectangular tassels of a multitude of colors hung from ties at the front, just below the neck. The faces of the women were all tattooed. "Release the power," Egwene said, letting go of Sidar. "Don't let them sense you." She dashed to the side, Lelaine following, the glow winking out from around her. Romanda ignored Egwene, letting out a curse. She began weaving a gateway to escape. A dozen different weaves of fire suddenly thrashed the area where Romanda stood. The woman didn't have a chance to scream. Egwene and the other women scrambled through the camp as weaves of the one power destroyed tents, consumed supplies, and set the entire place aflame. Egwene reached the command tent just as Gawain stumbled out. She grabbed him and pulled him to the ground as a ball of fire passed just overhead, then crashed into a collection of tents nearby. "Light," Gawain said. "What is it?"
"Sharon's."
Lelaine, breathless, huddled down beside them.
"Are you certain?" Egwene whispered. Lelaine nodded. "Accounts from the Kyrianen before the Aiel War are plentiful, if not very informative. They weren't allowed to see much, but what they did see looked a lot like that army."
"Army?" Gawain said, stretching to the side and looking between the tents toward the force marching through the unnaturally wide gateway.
"Blood and bloody ashes," he swore, ducking back. "There are thousands of them."
"Far too many to fight," Egwene agreed, mind working furiously. "Not pinned between them and the Trollocs as we are. We have to fall back."
"I just passed the order to Bryn to disengage the troops," Gawain said. "But, Egwene, where are we going to go? Trollocs in front? That army behind? Light will be crushed between them."
"Bryn would react quickly. He'd send a messenger through a gateway to the line captains."
"Oh, no."
Egwene grabbed Gawain and pulled him away from the command tent just as she felt channeling within. Lelaine cried out, ducking in the other direction. The Sharan women reacted immediately to the channeling. The ground ripped up underneath the tent, destroying it in a burst of overwhelming power. Tattered shreds of cloth flew into the air amid stones and clods of earth. Egwene fell backward, and Gawain pulled her toward a toppled cart that had been hit. One wheel shattered, its burden of firewood tumbling out. Gawain pulled Egwene to the sheltered place just under the edge of the cart, beside the tumble of wood. They huddled there, though the wood flickered with flames and the ground before them was a fire. The heat was distressing but not unbearable. Egwene huddled against the ground, blinking through eyes that burned with smoke, searching for signs of Lelaine, or light. Swan and Bryn had been inside that tent, along with Yukiri and many of their command staff. Egwene and Gawain hid as flames rained on the camp, tearing up the earth. The Sharans struck at any sign of movement. Several serving women who ran by were instantly immolated.
"Be ready to run," Gawain said, "once the fire stops falling."
The flames did wane, but just as they did, riders in Sharan armor charged through the camp. They hooted and yelled, leveling bows at anyone they saw, dropping dozens with arrows to the back. After that, the Sharan troops moved through the camp in tight formations. Egwene waited tensely, trying to think of how to slip away. She saw no opportunity. Gawain pulled Egwene back farther, rubbed soot on her cheeks, and motioned for her to stay low, then draped his warder cloak over them both. With the smoke from the wood burning nearby, perhaps they wouldn't be seen. Her heart thumped urgently in her chest. Gawain pressed something to her face, a kerchief he had soaked with his water skin. He held another one to his face and breathed through it. She took the one he was holding to her, but barely breathed. Those soldiers were so close. One of the soldiers turned toward the cart, peering at the woodpile, but when he glanced through the smoke toward them, he didn't seem to see anything. Egwene silently contemplated the warder cloak. Its color-shifting nature made them nearly invisible, if they were careful not to move. "Why don't I have one of those cloaks?" she thought with annoyance. "Why should they only be for warders?" The soldiers were busy flushing out servants. Those who ran, they killed with arrows from bows that stretched extremely far. Servants who moved more slowly, they rounded up and forced to the ground. Egwene longed to embrace the source, to do something, to bring down fire and lightning upon these invaders. She still had Vora's Sa'angreal. She quashed that line of thinking. She was surrounded by the enemy, and the swift reaction of the channelers indicated that they were watching for Aes Sedai. If she wove for a single moment, she'd be killed before she could escape. She huddled beside Gawain, under his cloak, hoping none of the Sharan channelers walked close enough to sense her ability. She could use a weave to hide that ability, but would have to channel first to use it. Dared she try that? They hid for a good hour or more. If the cloud cover hadn't been so complete, casting the land into perpetual twilight, they'd certainly have been spotted, cloak or no cloak. She almost cried out at one point when a few of the Sharan soldiers tossed some buckets of water onto the woodpile, stifling the fire and soaking both of them. She couldn't make out anything of her own army, though she feared the worst. The Sharan channelers and a large portion of their army moved through the camp quickly toward the battlefield. With Bryn and the Ammerlin gone, and with a surprise force coming in from behind, Egwene felt sick. How many were dying, dead? Gawain caught her arm as he felt her stir, then shook his head, mouthing a few words. "Wait until night." "They're dying," she mouthed. "You can't help." It was true. She let him hold her, letting his familiar scent calm her. But how could she simply wait, as soldiers and Aes Sedai who depended on her were slaughtered? Light. A huge portion of the White Tower was out there. If this army fell and those women with it. "I am the Ammerlin Seat," she told herself firmly. "I will be strong. I will survive. So long as I live, the White Tower stands." She still let Gawain hold her. Avienda crawled across the rock like a winter lizard seeking warmth. Her fingertips, though calloused, were beginning to burn from the bitter cold. Sheol Ghul was cold, with air that smelled as if it came from a tomb.
Ruark crawled to her left, a stone dog named Shane to her right. Both wore the red headband of the Siswayaman. She didn't know what to make of Ruark, a clan chief donning that headband. He had never spoken of it. It was as if the headband did not exist. So it was with all of the Siswayaman. Amis crawled on Shane's right. For once, no one had objected to wise ones joining the advanced scouts. In a place such as this, at a time such as this, the eyes of one who could channel might see what ordinary eyes would not. Avienda pulled herself forward, making no noise, despite the necklaces she wore. No plants sprouted on these rocks, not even mold or lichen. They were deep within the blasted lands now, almost as deep as one could go. Ruark reached the ridge first and she saw him tense. Avienda arrived next, peering over the side of the rock, keeping low so as not to be seen. Her breath stopped dead in her throat. She'd heard stories of this place, of the massive forge near the base of the slope, a single black stream running past it. That water had been poisoned to the point that it would kill any who touched it. Hearths dotted the valley like open wounds, reddening the fog around them. As a young maiden, she'd listened with wide eyes as an ancient roof mistress told of the creatures who worked the shadows' forges, creatures that were not dead and not alive. Silent and horrible, the brutish things moved with steps that held no life, like the ticking hands of a clock. The forgers paid little heed to the cages full of humans, whose blood would be spilled to temper newly forged blades. The captives might as well have been chunks of iron. Though Avienda was too far to hear the humans' whimpers, she felt them. Her fingers grew taut upon the rocks. Sheol Ghul itself dominated the valley, its black slopes rising like a serrated knife into the sky. The sides were rent with cuts, like the skin of a man who had been whipped 100 times, each score leaving a gash that spat steam. Perhaps that steam created the fog that lay over the valley. The fog churned and surged, as if the valley were a cup holding liquid. "Such a terrible place," Amis whispered. Avienda had never heard such dread in the woman's voice. That chilled Avienda nearly as much as the bitter wind that ruffled their clothing. Distant pings broke the air, the workers forging. A black column of smoke rose from the nearest forge and did not dissipate. It rose like an umbilical cord to the clouds above, which rained down lightning with dreadful frequency. Yes, Avienda had heard stories of this place. Those stories had failed to convey the full truth. One could not describe this place. One had to experience it. A scraping from behind, and in a few moments, Rodal Iteralda crawled up next to Ruark. He moved quietly for a wetlander. "You were so impatient that you could not await our report?" Ruark asked softly. "No report can convey what a man's own eyes can," Iteralda said. "I didn't promise I'd stay behind. I told you to go ahead, and you did." He raised his looking glass, shading the front with his hand, though that probably wasn't necessary with those clouds. Ruark frowned. He and the other Aiel who had come north had agreed to follow a wetlander general, but it did not sit well with them, nor should it. They would do this thing without growing comfortable. Comfort was the great killer of men. "Let it be enough," Avienda thought, turning back to look at the valley. "Enough for my people. Enough for Rand and the task he must accomplish." Seeing the end of her people had nauseated and horrified her, but also awakened her. If the end of the Aiel was the sacrifice required for Rand to win, she would make it. She would scream and curse the Creator's own name, but she would pay that price. Any warrior would. Better that one people should end
then the world fall completely under shadow. The light willing it would not come to that. The light willing her actions with the dragon's peace would serve to protect and shelter the Aiel. She would not let the possibility of failure stop her. They would fight. Waking from the dream was always a possibility when the spears were danced.
Interesting, Aiteralda said softly, still looking through his glass. Your thoughts, Aiel?
We need to create a distraction, Ruark said. We can come down the slope just to the east of the forge and set those captives free and break the place apart. This stops the Myrdral from receiving new weapons, and it will keep the Dark One's eyes on us and not the Karakarn.
How long will it take the dragon? Aiteralda asked. What do you think, Aiel? How much time do we give him to save the world?
He will fight, Amys said. Enter the mountain, duel with Sightblinder. It will take as long as a fight needs to take. A few hours, perhaps. I have not seen a duel last much longer than that, even between two men of great skill.
Let us assume, Aiteralda said with a smile, that there is going to be more to it than a duel.
I am not a fool, Rodol Aiteralda, Amys said coolly. I doubt that the Karakarn's fight will be one of spears and shields. However, when he cleansed the source, did that not happen in the space of a single day? Perhaps this will be similar.
Perhaps, Aiteralda said. Perhaps not.
He lowered the glass and looked to the Aiel. Which possibility would you rather plan for?
The worst one, Avienda said.
So we plan to hold out as long as the dragon needs, Aiteralda said. Days, weeks, months, years? As long as it takes.
Ruark nodded slowly.
What do you suggest?
The pass into the valley is narrow, Aiteralda said. Scout reports put most of the shadow spawn left in the Blight out beyond the pass there. Even they spend as little time as they can in this forsaken place. If we can close off the pass and seize this valley, destroy those forge workers and the few fades down there, we could hold this place for ages. You Aiel are good at slash-and-run tactics. Burn me, but I know that from personal experience. You lot attack that forge, and we'll set about closing up the pass.
Ruark nodded.
It is a good plan.
The four of them walked down the ridge to where Rand waited, dressed in red and gold, arms behind his back, accompanied by a force of 20 maidens and 6 Ashaman, plus Nynaeve and Moiraine. He seemed very troubled by something. She could feel his anxiety, though he should have been pleased. He had convinced the Seanchan to fight. What was it that, in his meeting with Egwene Alvere, had disturbed him so? Rand turned and looked upward toward the peak of Sheol Ghul. Staring at it, his emotions changed. He seemed a man looking at a fountain in the Threefold Land, savoring the idea of cool water. Avienda could feel his anticipation. There was also fear in him, of course. No warrior ever rid himself completely of the fear. He controlled it, overwhelmed it with the thirst to be on with the fight, to test himself. Men or women could not know themselves, not truly, until they were strained to their absolute limit, until they danced the spears with death, felt their blood seeping out to stain the ground, and drove the weapon home into the beating heart of an enemy. Rand Althor wanted this, and she understood him because of it. Strange to realize after all of this time just how alike they were. She stepped up to him, and he moved so that he stood just beside her, his shoulder touching hers. He did not drape an arm around her, and she did not take his hand. He did not own her, and she did not own him. The act of his movement so that they faced the same direction meant far more to her than any other gesture could.
Shade of my heart, he said softly,
watching his Ashaman open a gateway.
What did you see?
A tomb, she replied.
Mine?
No, that of your enemy, the place where he was buried once, and the place he will slumber again.
Something hardened inside Rand. She could feel it, his resolve.
You mean to kill him,
Avienda whispered.
Sightblinder himself.
Yes.
She waited.
Others tell me I am a fool for thinking this,
Rand said. His guards moved through the gateway to return to Merilor.
No warrior should enter a battle without intending to see that battle finished,
Avienda said. She hesitated after saying it, something else occurring to her.
What is it?
Rand asked.
Well, the greatest victory would be to take your enemy, Gai Shang.
I doubt he would submit to that,
Rand said.
Don't make jest, she said, elbowing him in the side, earning a grunt. This must be considered, Rand Althor. Which is the better way of Jito? Is imprisoning the Dark One like taking him Gai Shang? If so, that would be the proper path.
I'm not certain I care what is proper this time, Avienda.
A warrior must always consider Jito, she said sternly.
Have I taught you nothing? Do not speak like that, or you will shame me again before the other wise ones.
I had hoped that, considering how our relationship has progressed, we would be through with these lectures, Avienda.
You thought that growing closer to me would end the lectures? She asked, baffled. Rand Althor, I have been among Wetlander wives, and I've seen that they...
He shook his head, leading the way through the gateway, Avienda following.
He seemed amused, and that was good. Some of his anxiety had faded. But truly, this was not a jest. Wetlanders did not have good senses of humor. Sometimes they did not understand at all when to laugh. On the other side of the gateway, they entered a camp made up of many groups. Rand had command of the maidens and the Siswayaman, along with most of the wise ones. Just outside of the Aiel camp were the Aes Sedai. Rand had command of some 36, all of the Aes Sedai who had sworn to him personally, and most who were bonded to his Ashaman. That meant another 36 Ashaman of various ranks. He also had Rodal Aitaralda and his force, composed primarily of Damani. Their king, with his wispy beard and the beauty mark on his cheek, rode with them as well, but left the command to the great captain. The monarch gestured, and Aitaralda walked over to give a report. Al-Salam seemed uncomfortable around Rand, and did not go on any excursions when the dragon did. Avienda liked that arrangement. She wasn't certain she trusted this Al-Salam. Outside the Aiel tents camped another large military force, the Tyran Army, including the elite force known as the Defenders of the Stone, led by a man named Rodrivar Tihera. Their king was with them as well, and was generally considered the highest authority in their gathered armies aside from Rand. The Tyrans would form a key part of Rodal Aitaralda's plans. As much as it galled Avienda to admit it, Aitaralda was right. The Aiel were not a defensive force, and though they could hold a pass if needed, they would be better used for offensive maneuvers. The Tyrans would be perfect for holding ground. They had well-trained companies of pikemen and a full banner of crossbowmen with a new kind of crossbow crank, knowledge of which the smiths had only just received. They had spent the last week converting the equipment to the new style. There was one other group in Rand's force, and it was the most baffling to Avienda. Dragons sworn in large numbers. They camped together and flew a flag that placed the image of the dragon over the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai. The group was made up of common men, soldiers, lords, ladies, and some Aes Sedai and warders. They came from all nations, including the Aiel, and shared only one common bond. They had put aside all loyalties, broken all bonds to fight in the last battle. Avienda had heard discomforting rumors that many of the Aiel among them were Gai Shine, who had put aside the white, claiming they would take it up again when the last battle was won. Rand's coming was said to remove all bonds from men. Oaths shattered when he drew near, and any loyalty or alliance was secondary to the need to serve him in this last fight for humankind. Part of her wanted to name that wetlander foolishness, but perhaps she used that term too easily. A wise one had to see with better eyes than that. Now that they were on the other side of the gateway, Avienda finally allowed herself to release Sayidar. The world dulled around her, the added sense of life and wonder evaporating. Every time she released the one power, she felt slightly hollow. The joy and thrill now passed, over. Aetheralda and Ruark went to join King Darlin, speaking together about their battle plans. Avienda joined Rand as he walked toward his tent. "The dagger worked," Rand said. He reached down and fingered the black sheath that held the dull dagger. "Artham. I had heard them spoken of back in the Age of Legends, but nobody created one. I wonder who finally managed it."
"Are you certain it worked?" Avienda said. He could have been watching you but not exposed his hand.
"No, I would have felt the attention," Rand said. "It did work. With this he won't sense me until I step right up to the boar. Once he does know I'm there, he will have trouble envisioning me, striking at me directly. Avienda, that you should find this and identify it when you did. That Elaine should give it to me. The pattern weaves us all where we need to be."
Rand smiled, then added, "Elaine sounded sad when she gave me the dagger. I think a part of her wanted to keep it because it would let her curse by the Dark One's name without drawing his attention."
"Is this really a time for levity?" Avienda asked, scowling at him.
"If ever there was a need for laughter, this is it," Rand said, though the laughter seemed to have left his voice.
That anxiety of his returned as they reached his tent. "What is troubling you?" Avienda asked him.
"They have the seals," Rand said.
"What?"
"Only Egwene knows, but it is true. They were stolen, perhaps from my hiding place, perhaps after I delivered them to Egwene."
"Then they are broken?"
"No," Rand said. "I would feel that. I think they must be waiting. Perhaps they know that in breaking the seals they clear the way for me to reforge his prison. They'll break them at just the wrong moment, to let the Dark One touch the world. Perhaps to give him the strength to overwhelm me as I face him."
"We will find a way to stop this," Avienda said, voice firm. He looked to her and smiled.
"Always the warrior."
"Of course. What else would she be?"
"I have another concern. The Forsaken will try to strike at me when I enter to face him. The Dark One cannot see me, does not know where I am, and so is committing some of his forces to each of the different battlefronts. The Shadow pushes hard at land, trying to destroy him. The Dark One presses Elaine almost as badly in Kyrian. Only Egwene seems to be having some success. He searches for me at each of these battlefields, committing his creatures in large numbers. When we attack Sheol Ghul, we should be able to hold the valley against armies. The Forsaken, however, will come through gateways. Holding a pass will not stop them or the Dreadlords, male or female. My confrontation with the Dark One will draw them as the cleansing did,
only 1,000 times more urgently. They will come with fire and thunder, and they will kill.
So will we.
I'm counting on it, Rand said. But I cannot afford to take you into the cavern with me, Avienda.
She felt a sinking feeling,
though she attacked it, stabbed it, left it to die.
I suspected.
Do not think to send me away to safety, Rand Althor.
You would. I wouldn't dare, he said. I'd fear for my life if I were to try. There isn't any place that is safe now. I cannot take you into the cavern, because you will be needed out in the valley watching for the Forsaken and the seals. I need you, Avienda. I need all three of you to watch, to be my hands, my heart, during this fight. I'm going to send Min to Egwene. Something is going to happen there, I'm certain. Elaine will fight in the south, and you... I need you in the valley of Thakondar, watching my back. I will leave orders for the Aes Sedai and Ashaman, Avienda. Aitoralda leads our troops, but you command our channelers at Sheol Ghul. You must keep the enemy from entering the cavern after me. You are my spear in this battle. If they reach me while I am in the cavern, I will be helpless. What I must do will take all of me. All of my concentration, every scrap of power I have. I'll be like a babe lying in the wilderness, defenseless against the beasts.
And how is this different from how you usually are, Rand Althor? She asked. He laughed. It felt good to be able to both see and feel that smile.
I thought you said this wasn't a time for levity.
Someone must keep you humble, Avienda said. It would not do for you to think yourself something grand, simply because you save the world. He laughed again, leading her up to the tent where Min was. Nynaeve and Moiraine waited there too, one with annoyance on her face, the other serenity. Nynaeve looked very odd with her hair not long enough to braid. Today she'd pulled it up and pinned it back. Moiraine sat quietly on a large stone. Kalandor, the sword that is not a sword, lying across her lap, one hand resting protectively on its hilt. Tom sat beside her, whittling a stick and whistling softly to himself.
You should have taken me, Rand, Nynaeve said, folding her arms.
You had work to do, Rand said. You have tried as I instructed.
Time and time again, Nynaeve said. There's no way around the flaw, Rand. You cannot use Kalandor. It will be too dangerous.
Rand came up to Moiraine, reaching out his hand, and she lifted Kalandor for him to take. He raised it up before him, looking through its crystalline substance. It started to glow softly.
Min, I have a task for you, he whispered. Egwene is progressing well, and I feel her battlefront will be key. I wish you to go and watch her and the Shanshan Empress, whom I have asked to join that battlefront once their forces are ready.
You would have the Shanshan join Egwene's battlefront? Moiraine asked, aghast. Is that wise?
I cannot tell wisdom from brashness these days, Rand said. But I would feel better if someone were keeping an eye on those two factions. Min, will you do it?
I was hoping... Min looked away. Hoping he'd take her into the cavern, Avienda thought. But of course he could not.
I'm sorry, Min, Rand said. But I need you.
I will do it. Rand, Nynaeve said, you are taking Kalandor when you attack him? It's weakness. So long as you are channeling into that thing, anyone can seize control of you. They can use you and can draw the one power through Kalandor into you until it burns you out, leaving you powerless and leaving them with the strength to level mountains, destroy cities.
I will take it. Rand said.
But it's a trap, Nynaeve said.
Yes,
Rand said, sounding tired.
A trap I must stride into and allow to spring shut upon me.
He laughed suddenly, throwing his head back.
As always, why should I be surprised? Spread the word, Nynaeve. Tell Iteralda, Ruark, King Darlin. Tomorrow we invade Sheol Ghul and claim it as our own. If we must put our head into the lion's mouth, let us make certain that he chokes upon our flesh.
Chapter 21. Not a mistake to ignore. Suan rolled her shoulder. She grimaced at the sharp pain.
You Kiri, she grumbled. That weave of yours still needs work.
The tiny gray cursed softly, standing up from beside a soldier who had lost his hand. She hadn't healed him, instead leaving him to more mundane healers with bandages. To spend energy healing this man would be a waste, as he would never fight again. They needed to save their strength for soldiers who could rejoin the battle. It was brutal reasoning. Well, these were brutal times. Swan and Yukiri moved on to the next soldier in the line of wounded. The man with the missing hand would survive without healing. Probably. They had the yellows in Mayenne, but their energy was consumed in healing Aes Sedai who had survived the escape, and soldiers who could still fight. All through the makeshift camp, set up on Arafelin soil east of the river's ford, soldiers wept and groaned. So many wounded, and Swan and Yukiri were among the few Aes Sedai left with any strength to heal. Most of the others had drained themselves, making gateways to bring their army out from between the two attacking forces. The Sharans had attacked aggressively, but securing the White Tower's camp had occupied them for a while, giving time for the army to flee. Pieces of it, at least. Yukiri delved the next man, then nodded. Swan knelt down and began a healing weave. She'd never been very good at this, and even with an Angreal, it took a lot out of her. She brought the soldier back from the edge of death, healing the wound in his side. He gasped, much of the energy for the healing coming from his own body. Swan wavered, then fell to her knees in exhaustion. Light. She was as unsteady as a noblewoman her first day on the deck of a ship. Yukiri looked her over, then reached out for the Angreal, a small stone flower. Go rest, Swan. Swan clenched her teeth but handed over the Angreal. The one power slipped from her, and she let out a deep sigh, half relieved and half saddened at losing the beauty of Sidar. Yukiri moved to the next soldier. Swan lay back where she was, her body complaining of its numerous bruises and aches. The events of the battle were a blur to her. She remembered young Gawain Trakand bursting into the command tent, yelling that Egwene wanted the army to retreat. Bryn had moved quickly, dropping a written order through the gateway in the floor. That was his newest method of passing commands. An arrow shaft with a note and a long ribbon tied to it dropped through a gateway high above. There were no heads on the shafts, just a small stone to weight them. Bryn had been restless before Gawain appeared. He hadn't liked the way the battle had been playing out. The way the Trollocs moved had warned him that the Shadow had been planning something. Swan was certain he'd already prepared the orders. Then there had been the explosions in camp, and Yukiri yelling for them to jump through the hole in the floor. Light. She'd assumed the woman was mad. Mad enough to save all of their lives, apparently. Burn me if I'm going to lie here like a piece of yesterday's catch on the deck, Swan thought, staring up at the sky. She hauled herself to her feet and started stalking through the new camp. Yukiri claimed her weave wasn't all that obscure, though Swan had never heard of it. a massive cushion of air meant to cradle someone who had fallen a great distance. Crafting it had drawn the attention of the Sharans. Sharans, of all things. But they'd escaped. She, Bryn, Yukiri, and a few aides. Burn her, they'd gotten out, though that fall still made her wince to remember. And Yukiri kept saying she thought the weave might be the secret behind discovering how to fly. Fool woman. There was a good reason the Creator hadn't given people wings. She found Bryn at the edge of the new camp, sitting exhausted on a stump. Two battle maps spread out by stones lay on the ground in front of him. The maps were wrinkled. He'd grabbed them as the tent started to explode around him. Fool man, she thought, risking his life for a couple of pieces of paper.
From report, said General Harem, the new commander of the Ilianer Companions. I'm sorry, my lord. The scouts don't dare sneak too close to the old camp.
No sign of the Ammerlin? Swan asked. Bryn and Harem both shook their heads. Keep looking, young man. Swan wagged a finger at Harem. He raised an eyebrow at her use of the word young. Burn this youthful face she'd been given.
I mean it. The Ammerlin is alive. You find her, you hear me?
Yes, Aes Sedai.
He showed some measure of respect, but not enough. These Ilianers didn't know how to treat Aes Sedai. Bryn waved the man off, and for once it didn't look as if anyone was waiting to meet with him. Everyone was probably too exhausted. Their camp looked more like a collection of refugees from a terrible fire than it did an army. Most of the men had rolled themselves in cloaks and gone to sleep. Soldiers were better than sailors at sleeping whenever and wherever they could. She couldn't blame them. She'd been exhausted before the Sharans arrived. Now she was tired as death itself. She sat down on the ground beside Bryn's stump.
"I'm still hurting you?" Bryn asked, reaching down to rub her shoulder.
"You can feel that it is," Swan grumbled.
"Merely trying to be pleasant, Swan."
"Don't think I haven't forgotten that you're to blame for this bruise."
"Me?"
Bryn said, sounding amused. "You pushed me through the hole."
"You didn't seem ready to move."
"I was just about to jump. I was almost there."
"I'm certain," Bryn said.
"It's your fault," Swan insisted. "I tumbled. I hadn't intended to tumble. And Yukiri's weave. Horrible thing."
"It worked," Bryn said. "I doubt many people can claim to have fallen 300 paces and survived."
"She was too eager," Swan said. "She was probably longing to make us jump, you know. All that talk about traveling and weaves of movement."
She trailed off, partly because she was annoyed at herself. This day had gone poorly enough without her griping at Bryn.
"How many did we lose?"
Not a much better topic, but she needed to know.
"Do we have reports yet?"
"Nearly 1 in 2 of the soldiers," Bryn said softly.
Worse than she'd suspected.
"And the Aes Sedai?"
"We have somewhere around 250 left, Bryn said. "Though a number of those are in shock at having lost warders."
That was more of a disaster. 120 Aes Sedai dead in a matter of hours? The White Tower would require a very long time to recover from that.
"I'm sorry, Swan,"
Bryn said. "Bah," Swan said. "Most of them treated me like fish guts anyway. They resented me as Ammerlin, laughed when I was cast down, and then made a servant of me when I returned."
Bryn nodded, still rubbing her shoulder. He could feel that she was hurt, despite her words. There were good women among the dead, many good sisters.
"She's out there,"
Swan said stubbornly. Egwene will surprise us, Bryn. You watch.
If I'm watching, it won't be much of a surprise, will it?
Swan grunted.
Fool man. You're right, he said solemnly. On both counts. I think Egwene will surprise us. I'm also a fool.
Bryn,
I am, Swan. How could I miss that they were stalling? They wanted to occupy us until this other force could gather. The Trollocs pulled back into those hills, a defensive move. Trollocs aren't defensive. I assumed they were trying to set up an ambush only, and that was why they were pulling back corpses and preparing to wait. If I'd attacked them earlier, this could have been avoided. I was too careful.
A man who thinks all day about the catch he missed because of stormy weather ends up wasting time when the sky is clear.
A clever proverb, Swan, he said. But there's a saying among generals, written by Foch the Tireless. If you do not learn from your losses, you will be ruled by them. I can't see how I let this happen. I've trained better than this, prepared better than this. It's not just a mistake I can ignore, Swan. The pattern itself is at stake.
He rubbed his forehead. In the dim light of the setting sun, he looked older, his face wrinkled, his hands frail. It was as if this battle had stolen decades from him. He sighed, hunching forward. Swan found herself at a loss for words. They sat in silence. Lyrella waited outside the gates to the so-called Black Tower. It took every ounce of her training not to let her frustration show. This entire expedition had been a disaster from the start. First, the Black Tower had refused them entry until the Reds had done their business, and that had been followed by the trouble with gateways. That had been followed by 3 bubbles of evil, 2 attempts by Dark Friends to murder the lot of them, and the warning from the Ammerlin that the Black Tower had joined the Shadow to fight. Lyrella had sent most of her women to fight alongside Lan Mandragoran at the Ammerlin's insistence. She'd remained behind with a few sisters to watch the Black Tower. And now this. What to make of it?
I can assure you, the young Ashaman said, the danger has passed. We drove off them, Hale, and the others who turned to the Shadow. The rest of us walk in the light.
Lyrella turned to her companions. A representative from each Aja, along with backup, sent for desperately this morning when the Ashaman had first approached her, in the form of 30 other sisters. They accepted Lirella's leadership here, if only reluctantly. We will discuss it, she said, dismissing the young Ashaman with a nod.
What do we do?
Mirel asked. The Green had been with Lyrella from the start, one of the few that she'd not sent away, partially because she wanted the woman's warders near.
If some of their members are fighting for the Shadow...
Gateways can be made again, Ciane said. Something has changed about this place in the days since we felt that channeling inside.
I don't trust it, Mirel said.
We must know for certain, Ciane said. We cannot leave the Black Tower unattended during the last battle itself. We must see these men taken care of, one way or another. The Black Tower men claimed that only a few of their number had joined the Shadow, and that the channeling had been the result of an attack by the Black Aja.
It galled her to hear them use those words. Black Aja.
For centuries, the White Tower had denied the existence of Dark Friends among Aes Sedai. The truth had unfortunately been revealed. That didn't mean Lyrella wanted to hear men tossing around the term so casually, particularly men like these. If they'd wanted to attack us, Lyrella said speculatively, they'd have done it when we couldn't escape with gateways. For now, I will assume they have cleansed the problems among their ranks, as was required of the White Tower itself.
So we go in?
Mirel asked. Yes,
We bond the men we were promised and from them draw out the truth, if it is obscured. It troubled Lirella that the Dragon Reborn had refused them the highest ranking among the Ashaman, but Lirella had devised a plan when she first came here. It should still work. She would first ask for a display of channeling among the men, and would bond the one she felt was strongest. She would then have that one tell her which among the trainees were the most talented, so her sisters could bond those. From there, well, she hoped that would contain the majority of these men. Light. What a mess. Men who could channel. Walking about. Unashamed. She did not accept this fable of the taint having been cleansed. Of course these men would claim such a thing. Sometimes, Lirella muttered, I wish I could go back and slap myself for accepting this commission. Mirel laughed. She never did take events as seriously as she should. Lirella felt annoyed at having missed the chances to be had at the White Tower during her long absence. Reunification, fighting the Shanchan. These were the times when leadership could be proven, and a woman could gain a reputation for strength. Opportunities appeared during times of upheaval. Opportunities now lost to her. Light, but she hated that thought. "We will enter," she called up to the walls, framing the gate before her. Then, more softly, she continued to her women, "Hold the One Power, and be careful. We do not know what could happen here." Her women would be a match for a larger number of untrained Ashaman if it came to that. It shouldn't, logically. Of course, the men were likely mad, so perhaps assuming logic from them was imprudent. The large gates opened to allow her people in. It said something about these Black Tower men that they chose to finish the walls around their grounds before actually building their tower. She kneed her horse forward, and Mirel and the others followed in a clopping of hooves. Lirella embraced the source and used the new weave, which would tell her if a man channeled nearby. It was not the young man from a short time ago who met them at the gates, however. "What is this?" Lirella asked, as she was joined by Pavara Tazanovni. Lirella knew the Red Sitter, though not well. "I've been asked to accompany you," Pavara said cheerfully. Loghain thought that a familiar face might make you more comfortable. Lirella held in a sneer. "Aes Sedai should not be cheerful. Aes Sedai should be calm, collected, and, if anything else, stern. A man should look at an Aes Sedai and immediately wonder what he had done wrong and how he could fix it." Pavara fell in beside her as they rode onto the grounds of the Black Tower. "Loghain, who is in charge now, sends his regards," Pavara continued. "He was gravely wounded in the attacks, and has not yet fully recovered. Will he be well?" "Oh, certainly. He should be up and about in another day or two. He will be needed to lead the Ashaman as they join the last battle, I suspect." Pity, Lirella thought. The Black Tower would have been more easily controlled without a false dragon at their head. Better that he had died. "I am certain his aid will be useful," Lirella said. "His leadership, however..." "Well, we shall see. Tell me, Pavara, I have been told that bonding a man who can channel is different from bonding a normal man. Have you been through the process?" "Yes," Pavara said. "Is it true, then?" Lirella asked. "Ordinary men can be compelled with the bond to obey, but not these Ashaman?" Pavara smiled, seeming wistful. "Ah, what would that be like? No, the bond cannot force Ashaman. You will have to use more inventive means." This was not good. "How obedient are they?" Eledrin asked from the other side. "It depends on the man, I suspect," Pavara said. "If they cannot be forced," Lirella said,
Will they obey their Aes Sedai in battle?
Probably, Pavara said, though there was something ambiguous about the way she said it.
I must tell you something, all of you. The mission I was sent on and the one you also pursue is a fool's errand.
Is that so? Lyrella asked evenly. She was hardly going to trust a Red after what they had done to Swan.
Why is that?
I was once where you are, Pavara said, ready to bond all of the Ashaman in an attempt to control them. But would you ride into another city and select 50 men there at a whim and bond them as warders? Bonding the Ashaman just to bond them is foolish. It will not control them. I do think some Ashaman will make excellent warders, but, like many men, others will not. I suggest that you abandon your plan to bond exactly 47 and take those who are most willing. You will gain better warders.
Interesting advice, Lyrella said. But as you mentioned, the Ashaman will be needed at the battlefront. There is not time. We will take the 47 most powerful.
Pavara sighed, but said nothing further as they passed several men in black coats with two pins on the high collars. Lyrella felt her skin crawling as if insects burrowed beneath it. Men who could channel. Lilaine felt that the Black Tower was vital to the White Tower's plans. Well, Lyrella did not belong to Lilaine. She was her own person, and a sitter in her own right. If she could find a way to bring the Black Tower under her direct authority, then perhaps she could finally wiggle out from under Lilaine's thumb. For that prize, bonding Ashaman was worthwhile. Light, but she wasn't going to enjoy it. They needed all of these men controlled somehow. The dragon would be growing mad, unreliable by this point, tainted by the Dark One's touch on Sidim. Could he be manipulated into letting the rest of the men be bonded? Not having control through the bond, that will be dangerous. She imagined going into battle with ranks of 2 or 3 dozen Ashaman, bonded and forced to her will. How could she make it happen? They reached a line of men in black coats waiting at the edge of the village. Lyrella and the others approached them, and Lyrella did a quick count. 47 men, including the ones standing at the front. What trick were they trying to pull? The one at the front came forward. He was a sturdy man in his middle years, and he looked as if he'd recently suffered some kind of ordeal. He had bags under his eyes and wan skin. His step was firm, however, and his gaze steady as he met Lirella's eyes, then bowed to her.
"Welcome, Aes Sedai," he said.
"And you are?"
"Andral Genhald," he said. "I've been put in charge of your 47 until they have been bonded."
"My 47? I see that you have forgotten the terms already. We are to be given any soldier or dedicated we wish, and they cannot refuse us."
"Yes, indeed," Andral said. "That is true. Unfortunately, all of the men in the Black Tower, other than these, are either full Ashaman or have been called away on urgent business. The others would, of course, follow the dragon's commands if they were here. We made certain to keep 47 for you. Actually, 46. I've already been bonded by Pavara Sedai, you see."
"We will wait until the others return," Lyrella said coldly.
"Alas," Andral said, "I do not think they will return any time soon. If you intend to join the last battle, you will have to make your selections quickly."
Lyrella narrowed her eyes at him, then looked at Pavara, who shrugged.
"This is a trick," Lyrella said to Andral, "and a childish one."
"I thought it clever myself," Andral returned, voice cool. "Worthy of an Aes Sedai, one might say. You were promised that any member of the Black Tower, save full Ashaman, would respond to your request. They will. any of them to whom you can make the request.
Undoubtedly you chose for me the weakest among your numbers.
Actually, Andral said, we took those who volunteered. They're good men, every one of them. They're the ones who wanted to be warders.
The dragon reborn will hear of this.
From what I've heard, Andral said, he's heading to Sheol Ghul any time now. Are you going to join him there just to make your complaint?
Lirella drew her lips into a line.
Here's the thing, Aes Sedai, Andral said. The dragon reborn sent a message to us just earlier today. He instructed us to learn one last lesson, that we're not to think of ourselves as weapons, but as men. Well, men have a choice in their fate, and weapons do not. Here are your men, Aes Sedai. Respect them.
Andral bowed again and walked away. Pavara hesitated, then turned her horse, following him. Lirella saw something in the woman's face as she looked at the man. So that is it, Lirella thought. No better than a green, that one is. I would have expected more of one her age. Lirella was tempted to refuse this manipulation, to go to the Ammerlin and protest what had happened. Only, news from the Ammerlin's battlefront was jumbled, something about an unexpected army appearing. Details were not available. Certainly the Ammerlin would not be happy to hear complaints at this point. And certainly, Lirella admitted to herself, she also wanted to be done with the Black Tower. Each of you pick two, Lirella said to her companions. A few of us will take only one. Faelain and Theodrin, you are among those. Be quick about it, all of you. I want away from this place as soon as possible. Pavara caught up to Andral as he slipped into one of the huts. Light, she said. I'd forgotten how cold some of us can be. Oh, I don't know, Andral replied. I've heard that some of you aren't quite so bad.
Be careful of them, Andral, she said, looking back out. Many will see you as only a threat or a tool to be used.
We won you over, Andral said, walking into a room where Canler, Jonath, and Amarin waited with cups of warm tea. All three were beginning to recover from the fighting, Jonath most quickly. Amarin bore the worst scars, most of them emotional. He, like Loghain, had been subjected to the turning process. Pavara noticed him staring blankly sometimes, face etched by fear, as if remembering something horrible. You three shouldn't be here, Pavara said, hands on hips, facing Amarin and the other two. I know Loghain promised you advancement, but you still wear only the sword on your collars. If any of those women saw you, they could take you as warders.
They won't see us, Jonath said with a laugh. Andral would have us through a gateway before we had time to curse. So what do we do now? Canler asked.
Whatever Loghain wishes of us, Andral said.
Loghain had changed since the ordeal. Andral whispered to her that he was darker now. He spoke less. He did still seem determined to get to the last battle, but for now, he gathered the men in and pored over things they'd found in Taim's rooms. Pavara worried that the turning had broken him inside.
He thinks there might be something in those battle maps he found in Taim's chambers, Amarin said.
We'll go where Loghain decides we can be of most use, Andral replied.
A straightforward answer, but one that didn't actually say much.
And what of the Lord Dragon? Pavara asked carefully.
She felt Andral's uncertainty. The Ashaman Naif had come to them, bearing news and instructions, and with them some implications. The Dragon Reborn had known all was not well at the Black Tower.
He left us alone on purpose, Andral said.
He would have come if he could have, Jonath said. I promise you.
He left us to escape on our own, Amarin said, or to fall
on our own. He has become a harsh man. Perhaps Cal